Hello, Virgo, and welcome to the Somewhere in Between, your 2024 Plus astrology reading from Planet Waves. I'm Eric Francis, your astrologer for the next hour. Thank you for joining me here in the Astrology Chalet in Rosendale, New York. I am working in a new place and been doing these readings all week. I believe this is the 10th one. In the written readings as well, I got to Virgo and Libra at the very end, and as a result, I think they were both about 6,500 to 7,000 word readings. I'm not supposed to have more to say as they go on, but the charts are really interesting, and the way that your chart pans out is especially interesting. And look, the bottom line theme of Virgo astrology for 2024 and really 24 plus is your independence of thought, your independence of your value system, and relating to the world in the words of Erica Jong, not as half of a relationship, but as a whole person. Every last thing in your astrology confirms and affirms this, and yet, here on Planet Projection, it is one of the most difficult things to negotiate. It's one of the most difficult things to navigate. It is not easy to come out of this hall of mirrors in which we are living and to genuinely be independent. It's arguable whether it's possible at all, but I think there are, as with many things, there are degrees, but then there's also the matter of intent and what you want from your life and the extent to which you see certain aspirations that you have as being a function of your relationships, particularly your intimate sexual relationships, or you see them as being in some way separate from that. And it's difficult to know. And I realize that the matter of relationships is a very sensitive matter, and it's also something that is in many ways dependent upon personal karma and that of the people involved. And then that is to say, other people besides yourself. And then we are living in this world where we are under the total influence of something that, frankly, makes religion look harmless and benign. By which I mean, like, organized, structured religion that's designed essentially as a form of mind control, and that is the digital environment. The digital environment is extremely difficult to navigate. And it is a dehumanizing environment. And so for people who want to remain human, it is necessary at least to understand the influence of the digital environment. I'm not saying that any of us can actually remove ourselves from it. I mean, we really can't, no matter where we go. We're, unless you're on a mountaintop in the Andes, but still, you know, you're still carrying the frame of mind with you. So this is something we have to negotiate, something that we have to navigate our way through. We have to do it practically every minute of every day. And it is because the nature of your relationships is so, and including your working relationships, is so heavily influenced by digital conditions and electrical conditions generally, that I just want to kind of concisely summarize that. And the bottom line is that what I'm calling digital conditions are part of the dominant environment in which we live, and the environment shapes everything that we go through. There's no way to not be shaped in some way by the environment. There can be the nature versus nurture debate, but no one can deny that the experience of the environment has an influence, and that people are not, you know, you can't just hit the genetic lottery and be fine. One way or the other, your environment's going to shape you. And so by environment, I mean that essentially with the Virgo solar chart, and by the way, this is a reading of your solar chart. I should do a video on reconciling your solar chart with your natal chart, but let me give a 1-minute plug here. It's not about astrology theory. It's about the ideas of astrology rather than the ideas astrology leads to rather than the astrological rationalization that got there. The astrology rationalization is merely a set of logical steps to get to a conclusion, but you can get to Woodstock by car, you can get to Woodstock by motorcycle, you can get to Woodstock by scooter, and you can parachute into the territory. A lot of ways to get to Woodstock and a lot of ways to get to Burning Man. So the question is not, oh my God, this is a reading for Virgo, but I've got Sagittarius rising and I don't understand how to make these work together. Well, the question is, what's the outcome? What am I proposing or suggesting if you strip away all the astrology theory? I leave the astrology theory in because it's interesting to think it through, and this is an astrology reading project product, but I wouldn't be saying any of this to anyone without a chart to go by. So, that again said, let's take a look at an important fact of your solar chart. And the solar chart, remember, is the chart of the sign and not the person. So we're reading the archetype, reading for the archetype of Virgo. Conceptually, you may relate, you may not, but remember, this is about the sign Virgo, not your personal chart, which is a whole other astrological instrument, and it is played differently. For example, I would never talk about someone's chart for an hour and 15 minutes, but I can talk about a solar chart for an hour and 15 minutes. And one of the benefits is if you don't like what I say, you can say, well, it wasn't really my chart anyway. There you go. So, however, I'm continuing to advance my theory of Virgo in this reading. And now it's the theory of Virgo under digital conditions. So in astrology, there is something that my friend Annie Black came up with. It's a fairly simple concept, and it is she calls it the zone of projection. And the zone of projection, pardon me, I'm just coloring. The zone of projection is essentially a section of the western quadrant of the chart. So if you see here, in the solar chart, we start with Virgo as the reference sign. Any sign can be the reference sign. It all depends on what you're doing with astrology. You can set the moon as the reference sign. You can set Mars as the reference sign. You can set the sun, the ascendant, the part of fortune, the part of spirit, the part of the fair, the part of this, and the part of that. So Virgo is the reference sign for the Virgo reading, and this applies to Virgo, sun, and rising in the theory of sun sign astrology. Virgo, place one, Libra, place two, Scorpio, place three. The places all have their general theme, but remember, the chart is one whole complete gestalt. Sag, place four, Capricorn, very important in Virgo, place five. Aquarius, very important to Virgo, place six. These are, now we're getting to things that really are more descriptive of your experience. And this orange line here, this orange line that I've drawn around the outside of the wheel, encompasses houses five, six, seven, and eight. Shlemiel Schmazel has Rev Incorporated. Five, six, seven, and eight. They are the zone of projection. They're the zone of projection because in the imaginary story known as astrology, the stick figure of a person, a figure that's not, doesn't look like you, it's just figurative, stands on the first house and looks out at the world, and much of the world they're looking out at is houses 5, 6, 7, and 8. Now we have interior experiences in there, but houses 5, 6, 7, and 8 usually describe a very dynamic relationship with the outer facets of those environments. The outer facets of those environments. So, meaning that they tend to occur exterior to our body. They occur exterior to our personal, private identity. For example, the fifth house is a place of creation, art, risk-taking. You always interact with somebody else in that sense, or with something else. So if the if the thing you're doing in the fifth is making art or making a sculpture, well, you've created an other to work with. And in the sixth house, there is the relationship that is there's the relationship that's based on the work environment, the work itself that's being done, and the colleagues of that work, of which you have many. And we'll get, when we get into that house, that's Aquarius in the sixth. So look at all this activity, and it continues to go over the top of the chart into the 10th house, Gemini, and the 11th house, Cancer. Is that right? Yes. 10th house, Gemini, 11th house, Cancer. It's hard to look. I'm looking through the page because it's the light shining through, and then the screen is reversed from what I'm normally accustomed to. So your destination is to get here. I've got to mark this in colored pen because I'm going crazy with being dyslexic. Your goal is to basically get into this region, and I say that because that's about exploring the world. It's about letting go of certain trappings of relationship overly influencing who you think you are or your entire identity invested in that relationship. But one of the reasons that that's challenging is because of you have very personal signs, particularly Aries and Taurus, especially Aries. This is really the one that's so vital. The sign where you seek self-actualization is in the house where you seek to merge with others. And there's an inherent contradiction. Now, there are theories of personal growth that say that there's no way to grow that's not part of a relationship, and I'm not sure that's the case. Otherwise, the great swamis wouldn't sit in caves. I haven't ever met one who did, but I've heard of it, and it's an idea. Would not sit in caves, and there are certainly things that can be learned based on an inner relationship, and someone more spiritually inclined might say, well, everything you learn, you really learn from your inner teacher, and all this stuff going on in the world is just kind of practice. It's just kind of opportunities to express yourself and use what you've learned, or to contradict or challenge or whatever what you've learned. And you only grow through your experience of source. You only grow through your inner experience. So I'm not making any absolute statements here, but I am, of course, not. I couldn't. We obviously grow through both. But what I'm saying is that because you have Aries in the eighth place, and the eighth place is about merging with others, and Aries is about finding yourself, then the astrological syntax of that is you find yourself, or you attempt to find yourself through merging with others. A lot of people do, but it's very intensified for Aries and for Virgo. And the particular challenge here right now is that not only has Chiron been working this territory, which has been encouraging your independence, it's been saying, well, this process of merging with others until it doesn't work, and then I've got to find myself, and then I merge with someone, and then I find myself, which is a common pattern that many people have, but it looks to me like that one is getting near the end of its useful service life for you. And Chiron, a planet closely associated with Virgo, the healing attribute of Virgo, has been in Aries now for about 6 years. That's quite a while for a planet to have been in a particular part of one's chart. So in that respect, it's not new. But there is a property that Chiron has, which is a property of movement after long delay. And so when we think of Chiron in Aries being 6 years old, well, the events surrounding Chiron would matter a lot. And there is about to be an absolutely incredible total eclipse of the sun conjunct Chiron in your eighth house. solar house. This is going to open up something for you. It seems with the presence of the sun and the moon in an exact conjunction, conjunct Chiron, it just seems like there's something really valuable there that will guide you and teach you about the way that you merge and unmerge, and what your expectations going into the merger are, and then what they are coming out. Now, the presence of Aries in the eighth means you spend a lot of time wherever Aries is in one's chart. One spends a lot of time there, especially in our culture that is so basically, for lack of a better word, egocentric or neocentric or self-centric. And so that's going to emphasize Aries in almost everyone's life. But you have Aries in this chart where there's all these mysterious processes going on, and where there are deaths and transformations going on, and where it is essentially a transactional house. And then the nature of the transaction needs to be deciphered. It needs to be figured out. And with Aries there, it often feels like you're the thing being transacted. And I mean, I'm sure that you've noticed this at some point in your life, whether you're a man or a woman. Men and women are transacted in different ways, but how much of what propels the story of your life ends up being in some way transactional, a contract or a financial transaction of one kind or another. And Chiron is saying, well, there's something else here. There's another way to heal your sense of your being, and there are ways to proceed that involve fewer detours, for example. Fewer detours. So I'm not at all going to speculate what this eclipse conjunct Chiron will be about, except I can say a couple of things generally. One is it's likely to be the culmination of some journey or experience that goes back to around 2018 or 2019. Second, it's likely to influence the way that you perceive and treat others who are in close, intimate, financial, and or sexual partnerships with you. It may involve the affairs of someone who is no longer on the planet. And it is likely to involve some kind of tremendous localized in time, meaning in the spring, Northern Hemisphere, spring of 2024, localized in time transformation process that you just go through in a very, very concentrated way. And to me, it looks like a moment of liberation from some set of ideas, expectations, or practices that you've lived by for a long time. And it also seems like that one of the qualities of that is, what does it mean to find yourself in all the different ways you have found yourself? Where do you expect to find yourself? What is your sensation and feeling of finding yourself? What is your goal of finding yourself? What does it mean to actualize yourself, Aries, in the eighth, in the context of some powerful relationship, bonding, or orbit with other? And my hunch is that the underlying movement here is to somehow help you get yourself free to do certain things you absolutely want to do, but that the fulfillment of those desires is somehow linked to a self-concept that you are trying to become aware of and see the details of. Okay. And so you can make the changes, specific changes you need to make to liberate yourself and do those things. And there's a lot here. I think in the written reading, I kind of save houses 9 and 10 for the very end. So let's turn the dial back a little bit. One commenting on something in Virgo. There's a one of those hypothetical points. I know I'm one of the few astrologers these days using hypothetical points. And that's it's called Trans-Pluto. It's been in Virgo maybe for about 6 years. It spent something like 60, 70 years in Leo. It's circular orbit, not elliptical, very, very slow mover. And one of the qualities of Trans-Pluto is that it can make a person have very self-critical and have, take a narrow approach. And I say self-critical because it's in Virgo. So to me, it has a way of ramping up the self-critical quality of Virgo that we pretty much know is a challenge for Virgo, holding yourself to a very high standard. You're always your own worst critic, but that doesn't really work so good because there's only so much you can critique yourself without having to kind of off-gas and like disabuse yourself of the burden of self-criticism, and then it enters into your environment, and things that may have nothing to do with your relationships suddenly are they're like the relationship is focused on it, like this is how it is all of a sudden. So I want to propose being cautious of the self-critical quality associated with having Trans-Pluto in Virgo. And I would say that I'm not really an expert on Trans-Pluto, but I've been looking at it for a long time. And I would say that one of the themes of Trans-Pluto that's worked is to be open-minded, to be open to different possibilities, and to not not constrain yourself in a limited set of self-concepts, and to recognize when the limit you're coming up against is a limit associated with a self-concept. Okay, skipping ahead to Capricorn, I have often felt that one of the most challenging things about Virgo, the archetype, Virgo, the idea of Virgo, the sign, is having Capricorn in the fifth place. In the fifth place, place number, how do we do this? Place number five. One, two, three, four, five. And the reason, if you take a look at your chart, you'll see anything that's in the fifth place to anything else is going to be in the same element, earth to earth. And the fifth wants freedom. The fifth wants experience. The fifth wants fun and play. The fifth wants to explore. The fifth wants to create something new. But you have Capricorn covering the fifth house of your solar chart or your fifth by whole sign if you're Virgo rising. And Capricorn doesn't inherently know how to have fun. There's a lot of responsibility implied in Capricorn. There's a lot of the need to take authority, be subject to authority, or sometimes to challenge authority. So the fifth place Capricorn for Virgo is one of those things that describes having grown up too young and not having had the sufficient creative play space to grow and to explore. Things with Capricorn on the fifth that should be more free and more fun can be very commitment-oriented. And so one of the things that's been happening is that Pluto has been working its way through Capricorn since 2008. And this is the latest in a series of transits, but really one of the most deep. 1993 was a very important time for this issue. I'm curious what you were going through in 1993. If you would be so kind as just to generally describe that in the comments below, what were you going through in 1993, the time of the Uranus-Neptune conjunction in Capricorn? Is that Pluto has been helping you to break down those thought compartments and those preconceived ideas that say, ultimately, everything that's fun must come back very, very quickly to responsibility. That's not that much fun. I mean, it's one thing to be responsible for the choices that you make. It's another thing to, you know, you go bungee jumping, the cord breaks, and, base jumping, you jump off and like, oh, either way, you're jumping off a cliff. So you're unlikely to take that kind of risk. In fact, Capricorn on the fifth describes a kind of risk aversion. Capricorn has a strong element of fear and a strong element of guilt to it, and this is something we have to deal with. But except for one thing, Pluto has been kind of jamming that. It has been breaking down those compartments and those obligatory fears from the past. I mean, many of us have neurotically paranoid and fearful parents. If I adopted all my dad's fears, I wouldn't have ever done anything. I wouldn't get in front of this camera and talk to you for 1 minute. But people deal with this more or less well, usually less well, and do a lot of adopting their parents' fears and become exactly like their parents. And Pluto has challenged that. Pluto has provided a kind of a territory to break down that thought structure and has encouraged you to have more of your own fun. Now, this is one of the first things in this discussion that contradicts the whole idea of having Aries in the eighth and having being invested in other people. But you would know. I wouldn't know about how this works for you. I just have no idea how it works for you because I'm not in your framework. I'm not in your body. I don't know you. I've never, maybe I've met, but I'm not hearing from you about this. And so like having Aries in the eighth, there's the implication that every last thing you do must involve some kind of a long-term permanent commitment. And this is one of the things that Capricorn has been taking on the chin from Pluto, essentially upending all concepts of kind of structured traditional commitment. And by the way, suddenly now the New York Times is writing about polyamory. Come on. It was considered the very height of controversy just 10 years ago in mainstream society. Well, now like a lot of things. It's like, oh, polyamorous mom had a sexual adventure right in the fucking New York Times. So, you need to have your own fun. I'm going to get right in the camera like Tom York. You need to have your own fun. Part of having your own fun is it's fun if you think it's fun, and it doesn't matter what anyone else thinks. No one has to approve, and you don't have to sign up to do it tomorrow. You can go paintball shooting and rent the paintball gun. And that's it. You did it once, and that's it. Or you can join the paintball club and be in it. Like you can go every day and go through one Tyvek suit a week. I mean, whatever you think your fun is, you don't need anyone's permission. You don't need mother, father, grandma, grandpa, husband, boyfriend, wife, spouse, children. One of the ways Virgos have less fun is children. But then when the kids are grown up, well, do Have the fun. If the kids are like away for the weekend, do the naughty thing. Whatever that is. Race car driving. Sex on the art studio couch. My metaphor of the fifth house. Whatever. It's your fun. There are... Pluto's leaving tomorrow. It'll be back for about 10 weeks in the Northern Hemisphere autumn. That's kind of a... That's a kind of a quick bow. That's like, I equate that to, when you leave, when you move out of a hotel room, you've been in a hotel room for a couple of days, like you look around, you check the bathroom, you quickly pull out the drawers, you quickly check the closet, you pull the sheets back, make sure you didn't leave anything under the sheets, and then you leave. That's Pluto going back into Capricorn. It's just that quick last check and say, oh, what that is. And you hope that, you know, if you forgot something, maybe the... place will call you. But Capricorn's not completely done yet. In fact, there are new long-term transits in Capricorn, but they're of a very special nature. And this could be like a major article, and I'd have to review all my thinking through of this, but I include this group of planets in every chart that I make. I include this group, and the group is Pholus, Quaoar, or Quaoar. I'm not sure which. I used to say Quaoar, and then someone corrected me. Now it seems to be Quaoar, and Ixion and Cupido. So this is a diversity of characters in there, but to me they all point back to ancestry before your great grandparents. Great grandparents, a lot of neurosis is contained right in the immediate sphere of the immediate ancestors. Like we either know how much we love the great grandparents, or we know how fucked up they were. We've heard some of the stories, and maybe we met them, and we know the grandparents they did a number on or whatever. But I think that's a distorted version of ancestral consciousness, and we have to go far beyond the great grandparents to have some idea of what was up. And I mean, I knew personally 1, 2, 3 of my great-grandparents. I knew all of my grandparents. My parents were still on the planet, but I don't really know anything about my great-grandparents that much, except to say that I had a apparently extremely wealthy great-grandmother who lived in absolute total squalor in the Bronx. I mean, like, the entire apartment building smelled of piss. This is one of these weird cases. Well, and it happens a lot where they can't get out of that level of consciousness, no matter how much money they have in the bank. They're going to live in this walk-up that smells like piss. My mother once went to the bathroom in that apartment, and there was a chicken in the bathtub that was about to become dinner. The good old days. Now you just go to the supermarket. So what I'm saying here is, if you're on fun patrol, if you're on like wondering about this growing up too soon thing and all this burden responsibility put on you as a child, and why maybe you seemed so old as a child, yes, look at your great-grandparents. Look at your grandparents. And then for more information about setting yourself free from whatever they did and all the alcohol they consumed, whatever else, maybe you've got to go back to something approximating some kind of tribal origins. There's got to be some kind of trip to the I highly recommend trips to the old country. I think it's very important to know the difference between an Italian and an Italian American, a Sicilian and a Sicilian American, a Jew thinking you're an Israelite, but really your family is from Ukraine. Now you can't go to Ukraine. But, for example, German Jew, go to Germany and see what's going on. If your family's Italian, maybe take a trip to Italy. There's always some kind of a breakthrough involved when you see the things they saw, walk on the ground they touched, and ate something like the food they ate. So that's just apropos of closure on the Pluto transit. Now we get to Aquarius in the sixth here, six places from the rising sign. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This is just a map of consciousness. Works pretty good. It may not work for you, but it works pretty good as a thought experiment. This is what all of this is. Place six for Virgo, Aquarius. We know that Virgos have a reputation for being dedicated to service and helping others and working tirelessly. Other signs have that, and other signs should have it and don't have the reputation. But Virgo is one of those signs where, you know, if you like need something done, give it to a Virgo. But there's, what's underneath that? Well, the fifth house, limit your fun. And the sixth house involves commitments to the commitments of others, essentially. Sixth house is where you find, sixth house is where you do your work. It's where you seek well-being, where you seek wholeness, where you seek a sense of belonging on the planet. Now, you have Aquarius there, and so there's something to work with in this seeking a sense of belonging vis-a-vis Aquarius, and also the fact that there is a lot of pressure put on us by anything of an Aquarian nature. I don't mean Aquarius people. I don't mean the Broadway show Aquarius. I don't mean a glass of water. I mean that the concept of Aquarius includes the, not the people, the concept of Aquarius includes the concept of peer pressure, of consensus reality, of groupthink. And you're good at navigating that realm, but it's not that expressive of what you personally want and need to do so that you can have the growth experiences and the creative experiences that you want. So now you've got Capricorn saying, well, you can't have too much fun. You're exceeding your quotient for fun in this lifetime, which you're not. And then Aquarius is saying, well, the thing that you're going to do that serves has to be something that comports with all what all the rest of us think should be done that would serve. And maybe, you know, maybe your idea of charity is not writing a check, but walking around and giving out pairs of socks for people, whatever it might be. But where there's Aquarius, you know there's going to be the element of peer pressure. And now Pluto is coming. And Pluto is coming to say, it's time to assert yourself. It's time to serve in the way that you alone think is the right way to serve. Now, I don't really think you're going to go off the rails here. You know, and we're still talking about someone who serves, but your way of serving, you may wake up one morning, decide you're going to set up volleyball tournaments at clubs in the Caribbean or whatever it might be. So that might not get win the like a peer pressure award, but you want to do that. So Pluto is going to shift your relationships to groups. And it's going to, one of the central ideas of Pluto and Aquarius is shocking this groupthink insanity that has taken over during digital conditions. I mean, really taken over. And it is unconscionable that it is like this. And look, society tends to march off to war. Everyone thinks, oh, now it's time for a war. Oh, now I've got to get those guys. Now I've got to get those guys. Now I've got to get those guys. Who is really saying, who breaks that consensus? They call you a communist or whatever they do. But Pluto in Aquarius is going to be about challenging the consensus of work, and let me add wellness. I think I mentioned this a couple of times. I would strongly suggest, and I mean, I can say this because I'm an astrologer and not a therapist, so take it for what it's worth. For you, there's an extreme danger in making any modification to your body or your routines or your behavior associated with your health because other people think you should, or other people try to force you to do it. Anyone who tries to force you to do anything, take a pill, get an injection, get an operation, do this kind of exercise because everyone else is doing it, that's time you say, ciao Bella, it's been lovely, go keep your shit. And then you decide what is the right thing for you. But if a vote is taken, if you think I've got to do this thing because there seems to be a plebiscite being taken, there seems to be a consensus forming that everyone has to, you know, the paper, do this. Chances are it's not going to work for you. This is very important for Scorpio, very important for Libra, very important generally, but you have Aquarius, the sign of groups, groupthink, and peer pressure on your sixth house. Therefore, a committee of one gets things done. You make your decisions. If you've done anything you regret, figure out how to improve that situation. A lot of people regret having fallen for the peer pressure scene in every single respect in 2020 and 2021. Everyone wanted me to do it. Now I feel about that. By the way, not for nothing, Saturn, during the lockdown era, Saturn entered Aquarius. That's what it looked like. I mean, it didn't really look like that, but Saturn entered Aquarius. Saturn entered Aquarius. Right. So, and that means that for the 3 years of the lockdown, 3 years, well, the lockdown goes on for kind of a year and a half. They kind of, depending on where you were, dragged it out, lifted mandates way too late, declared emergencies over 2 years after they didn't really begin. Saturn was in Aquarius. You may have really been feeling the pressure to conform to what other people wanted. And I am sorry if you made any decisions that you regret. Please figure out what to do about them. You're not trapped by them. Saturn then went into Pisces. And if I recall correctly, I put a lot of energy into describing the problem, the challenge of Neptune in Pisces. Challenge of Neptune in Pisces is that in this very, let's say, extra special part of the zone of projection, house number 7. I'm going to highlight that in yellow Sharpie. I drew the wrong glyph in here. I drew the glyph of Poseidon and not Neptune. Close enough. That's Neptune in the 7. So we're still in the zone of projection here. And we're in the part of the zone of projection where it's like you just walk around and look at things and you kind of see the world halfway between as it is and as you are. When you put Neptune there, which it's been now for 12 years, it creates a distortion. It's almost like having like a bubble lens that makes it very difficult to see distances, see perspective, feel emotional proximity, if have any understanding with people, and also it creates an illusion of isolation. And I have a Neptune seventh line when I go to the West Coast. So that means to say Neptune moves from Scorpio on my 5th, and if I just go over 3 time zones or 4 time zones, I wind up with Neptune bang on my 7th. I'm Taurus rising on the West Coast. Well, I lived out there and for about four years, and I felt so isolated. Now, I don't really know a lot of people I can actually talk to, like pretty much anywhere. I'm happy to have anybody I can have a conversation with. But when I look back on that phase, I'm like, wow, wait, I had so many interesting experiences with people. The point of isolation might have been that I had the experience, but then it wasn't the experience I really wanted. I wanted things to maybe last a little longer. And what Annie Black said, hi Annie, I'll send you this video. What Annie said was, well, it's a great position if you want people to kind of dream their way in and out of your life, and you want to have like a lot of fantasy-driven experiences, that's Neptune in the 7th house. But it felt isolating at the time, like there was this kind of invisible barrier. And that's what Neptune can feel like in any manifestation of Neptune in the 7th house. It can feel like there's this bubble that you're inside of between you and the world. Okay, so not that easy. I'm not sure how you felt it and how you experienced this, if at all. But and it's important because you make a lot of choices about who to invest yourself in and why you choose to invest yourself in them. And there may have been some misguided choices there because you had one concept that turned to be absolutely not having anything to do with anything that was real. Saturn's now here. And Saturn is, I like Saturn. I think anybody who is astrologically savvy needs to have a good relationship with Saturn, because it's the thing that most people have the most issues with. And if you kind of wonder how I get so much done, it has a lot to do with having a very strong Saturn and a strong Chiron. Saturn going into the seventh, right? Because now Saturn, as of last year, Saturn went from being in lockdown mode in the sixth. I mean, perfect metaphor, right? But Saturn went from lockdown mode being in the sixth into full-on zone of projection mode in the seventh a year ago. It's now coming to a new peak in 2024. In fact, there really hasn't been a peak of Saturn in Pisces yet. There's been no real major kind of development of Saturn, like a big aspect pattern or something like that. But there is one coming up. And it's more than enough that Saturn has joined Neptune in your seventh, because Neptune is the fantasy principle. Saturn is the reality principle. But this can feel really bubble bursting, like disillusioning. I think of a couple of other things. But there is a necessary awakening to reality associated with Saturn coming into Neptune's realm, and it is going to give you the ability to clean up certain boundaries in your relationship, to clean up your sense of your commitments. Very eighth house as well, but the eighth house starts in the seventh house, and to reassess, to reevaluate the decisions you have made, possibly going back 12 years. And what was the basis of those decisions? Every decision you make stems from what you think you are. And so based on what you are, you're going to make, based on what you think you are, you're going to make different decisions for yourself that are based on that concept. And Saturn is here for a review. Now, you've also had a big review, which is going to move into the eighth, Aries, with Neptune in 2025. So this review continues, and Saturn comes to a peak of its activity in Pisces in July, and then it comes to another peak of activity in February of 2025. And then in through 2025, Saturn and Neptune basically move together into Aries and continue this relationship to existence reevaluation, basically. There has been another dweller on the threshold of the seventh house, and for going back to about 14, I believe, and that is Nessus. Nessus is a centaur, like Chiron, dedicated to healing, and it's very much about the consequences of things. And Nessus is, I think, a somewhat pernicious influence in Pisces, because Pisces has a way of turning what could be clear and making it obscure. And one of the, and I'm giving this talk in every sign, one way, shape, or form, it just happens that yours is in the seventh house, is that Nessus deals with ambiguities around this, I think, very specious concept of consent, sexual consent. If you've heard any of my talks on this, I think the concept of consent in sexual relationships is complete and utter legalistic, politicized horseshit, very dangerous as such. Consent has nothing to do with desire. It has nothing to do with love, loyalty, or friendship. It is merely a legalistic concept. We know about those. Legalistic concepts are only as good as the language of the contract, and of the enforceability of the contract, and loopholes in the contract. It's a bunch of crap. But Nessus, the story of Nessus, which is a part of its overall action, but it's an important part of the story, involves a sexual encounter where the translation of the myth, as related to me by the by the Dieter Koch, Melanie Reinhardt, Robert von Heeren team, people I know, where the sexual encounter, it is unclear in the story whether Deianira chose to have sex with Nessus, whether he raped her, or whether she fucked him for the toll crossing the river, of which Nessus was the keeper of the river. You think, oh, it's too bad. We don't know the real reason that they had sex. Yeah, we know something more important. We know that the reason is hazy and ambiguous, where it should never be hazy and ambiguous. I don't think there's any person who has not had sex for the purpose of gaining something at some point, or had sex voluntarily, and most of us have had sex taken from us in some way. We've all had all three experiences. But the just about, I talked to a lot of people about this. It seems like this is how it is. And by the way, the most important use of sex as a toll for something is marriage. This has got to be called what it is. It's essentially a deed. This is being challenged legalistically, but where? Okay, so the pressure is on to get rid of this whole haze and ambiguity around consent. A completely reversible contract these days. Oops, I gave consent, now I take it back. That was yesterday, this is today. You, Mr. Smith, are still in trouble. This is going to become very costly. The karma is going to catch up with this modus operandi of not taking responsibility for sexual choices. It's essential to take responsibility for sexual choices. It's one of the reasons why they're there. It's the only sensible outcome of even having the possibility of making sexual choices, relational choices, but especially because of Nessus, sexual choices. She didn't really... She was delivered to Nessus by Heracles, her husband. She was just like walking down the road and met Nessus one day. Nessus, I don't know exactly the... It's a little sketchy, it's a myth, but she's there and she's got to cross the river. Well, what exactly happened? Well, you may not know that story of what exactly happened, but you know what happens in your life, and you know why you're motivated to do things. And I think it's very important to honor your own reasons for doing things and realize that with choice comes responsibility, plain and simple, and that's just how it is. And Saturn makes a near miss conjunction in July. I think this is going to finally surface as an issue. This question of, whether consent can be revoked, and why people all arguing for agency, people arguing for personal agency, personhood, would want anything to do with arguing against agency and blaming everyone else for what happens to them. So that's my rant on that. The conjunctions are July and February. It's near miss in July, one time full pass in February of 2025, about a year from now. Okay, we've talked extensively about the 8th. That's where this eclipse happens. The eclipse on April 8th is likely to be part of an acceleration. So look for the quickening in your intimate partnerships, and also on an interior space of any sense of urgency around the need to become, to actualize. And this, in temporal terms, is one and the same with, it's like 12 days apart, they're happening approximately at the same time as the conjunction of Jupiter and Uranus in your 9th house. This is a radical expansion of your sense of the world, your sense of belonging, your sense of being on the planet, and your relationship to the larger planetary environment. your relationship to existence. It's very much a ninth house matter. We're adjusting the lights here. I'll warm that up a little bit. Okay, so you are likely to already be having some expanded sense of your possibilities. I mean, this is what this aspect is about. But the ninth is really about possibilities. And one way to know that you're really riding the horse of this event is that you are able to transcend what would seem to have been limitations imposed by tradition. That's Taurus, is tradition, and it also can imply or express limitations of tradition. Can't do that then, because that's what tradition says. Can't do that then, that's what tradition says. If I marry a shiksa, my parents won't talk to me. Whatever. Well, why not? Really? I've heard that a lot of times. Big world. It looks to me like this ninth house conjunction, ninth house, the world itself, the big world, traveling far away, borrowing from Sagittarius, the great attractor, Lenny Achaea, the great and distant voyage, the Theoria, the reaching the sacred site. Now, I usually give a travel alone rant. I'm not sure you've heard of it. I'm not sure you're interested in what I have to say. But when one is traveling, either on business or important personal karmic business, I think there should not be a travel partner involved unless it's a healthcare aide who does exactly what you say. There should be no need to take a vote. If you're in Athens one day, and it's like you realize you've got to get the next train to Delphi because you need to be at the Delphic Oracle for the full moon, you've got to be able to take the train to Delphi or the flight to get to the Delphic Oracle for the full moon, because you know it's not going to be the same if you miss it. And it's very difficult to do that quite often with a travel partner who may want to go out and party. So I think most people don't need travel partners. Most people wouldn't conceive of getting on an airplane without someone else. I mean, there's a lot of people, even, I don't know, maybe it's not like this, who wouldn't even sit down in a restaurant and have dinner without someone else. But there seems to be a confluence of events describing you finding your true independent sense of your own being as completely shorn from the attitudes, the values, the pressures of others. It's all there. Pluto having come through the fifth. Have your own fun. Don't let your grandparents, great-grandparents decide what fun is. Pluto in Aquarius saying, nope, we don't take a vote on what is the right job for me. We don't take a vote on whether I get injected. We don't take a vote on whether I have an operation. You make your mind up. Okay, Saturn coming into the seventh. That's all about independence. Independence from illusions. It's about clearing relationships out of your life that are not working for you. Okay, fabulous. Saturn conjunct Nessus in Pisces in the seventh. That's all about taking responsibility for your relational sexual choices. Okay, next we have the eighth house. That's the house of self merging with other. Self is very strong for you in Aries, merging with other. This is, in fact, practically irresistible way that you're going to find yourself, except that Chiron is there, and Chiron is about the maverick. Chiron is another symbol of independence from the influences and thoughts and preferences and prejudices of other people. And Taurus on the ninth is saying, you need your own creative way to relate to the creator. Your relationship to your higher self, your angels, your mentors, your guides, the books that you read, nobody else's business but your own. Okay. Last house. We get all the way up to the 10th house. The chart, it's almost like this, it's almost kind of like the Labors of Heracles, where it's like, okay, we've done that house, now we've done that house, now we've done that house, now we've done that house. You acknowledge the mission, the lesson, the background of all the different houses, and then often it seems to lead to a culmination event. The culmination event could be you've got to go somewhere because you know it's going to change your life. But there seems to be a special thing where you initiate a whole new phase of taking action. Now, that I say that because not only because Jupiter is going into Sedna and into Gemini, but Sedna is going into Gemini. That's what it doesn't look like. It's just in the diagram. Jupiter going through your 10th house is a nice thing. It's usually indicative of some form of success, a windfall. You get a promotion. You get a new job. You try something. But this is very much deepened with a whole new sense of gravitas when we add a planet with an 11,400-year orbit, which has not been in Gemini, assuming the astrophysicists got all their mathematics correct, which I have seen them be pretty good most of the time, pretty accurate. It hasn't been there since like right after the last ice age ended. We have no idea what Sedna in Gemini is about, except we know that Sedna has something to do with environmental conditions. And this emerged. And I take a long time to decide what new planets are about, and I've been on the Sedna case since pretty much the day that its discovery was announced. And we were told that was in Taurus. This is 2003, and it was big news at that point. Well, if we move Sedna from Taurus, the physical world, to Gemini, the mental world, this is highlighting a property of the mental environment. This is telling us there's something shifting in the mental environment that really should get our attention. Now, the 10th is the house of where you take action. It's also the 10th of there's two vocational houses, 6 and 10, really. And is an important one. And it's higher profile, and the actions count for more, and there's more sense of intermingling and commingling with authority in the 10th house, and taking authority as much as being subjected to it. Taking authority is very important, and in the 10th, because it's your house of choose your destiny. That's the basic underlying implication of the 10th house. To the extent you can choose your destiny, one of the places you do it is with your 10th house resources. That includes natal planets and it includes transits. So check your 10th in your natal chart if your ascendant is not Virgo, and tell me what you have in Gemini that would influence this in some way. But what I'm getting at here is one of the gifts of your astrology of 2023 is to be highly sensitive to the mental environment, to pay attention to the currents and the modes and the processes of the mental environment. If you haven't noticed, I'm interviewing flat earthers lately. You may think that. What fucking idea is that? What a waste of time to interview flat earthers, like people who don't realize that the sun is not rising, the earth is turning, it looks like the sun is rising. Well, I'm interested in how they got to their thinking and what they have to say about all the demonstrated proofs. I don't mean photographs from space. We can all agree, I'm happy to throw the photos out. But there's lots of other evidence, and I want to know about their relationship to that evidence, and I'm most interested in their frame of mind, their state of mind that is leading to this. And my theory is this is a consequence of the digital state of mind, which is completely dominating the mental environment. There's basically no escaping from it. There is no escaping from the digital state of mind unless you insert yourself into the mental environment as a probe. The probe is usually some form of artist. The probe is someone who does something to experiment, who takes a risk of some kind, and then you mingle part of your aura with the environment and you study the interference pattern. That's basically what art is. Right, because every artist is interested in the response of people to their art, and while you may not be trying to change the world, every actual piece of art represents a probe into the world, which allows there to be a kind of state of mind experiment. And we have a lot to learn about the digital state of mind, and to the extent that you are concerned that the human race is being dehumanized, and that humans are selling themselves down the river of transhumanism, and that people just don't seem like people anymore, and like, what is all this fear, and what is all this pressure, and why is everyone so miserable all of a sudden? Why is the dominant emotion anxiety almost all the time? When you could say, well, because the economy is about to collapse, or this is going to happen, or that's going to, but that's those are figments. People who are perfectly well set, who would be situated pretty much just fine in case the economy collapsed, are still, a lot of them are still largely miserable and driven by greed and by little sense of what the possibilities are here. What are the possibilities? Well, one of the most important things you can do, I'm going to give you any advice in this, not that I haven't, and I can say this because, again, I'm not a therapist. Thank God, I'm an astrologer. Pay attention to the mental environment. Study it like a sailor studies the weather. The clouds. Wake up in the morning and look at the configuration of the cloud patterns, the temperature, the barometric pressure, the humidity, what the prognosticators say might happen later that day. Is the Coast Guard flying one triangle, two triangles, one square in a box, or another two squares in a box? What's going on there? The weather, the mental weather. Study the mental weather and look for the large unrecognized trends of the mental weather. As I said a number of times in this series, this is about the mental environment. The problem with environments is that they are largely invisible until there's a shift in the environment. So most people don't think about electricity till the power goes off. You don't think about being on dry land till your house is flooded. You don't think about a lot of things until the environment totally changes or falls apart in some way. Hence, the environment tends to be invisible. But if you are a conscious probe, if you are working that probing quality by being a little bit daring and less risk-averse and noticing how people respond to things and to you and being as objective as you can, it's very easy to abuse inductive logic and say, well, I had a girlfriend named Debbie, and she wasn't nice to me. I had another girlfriend named Debbie, and she wasn't nice to me. All Debbies are not nice. That's not true. But that's an example of the abuse of inductive logic. When you're evaluating the environment, you need to be very careful to have reality checks and to be circumspect. One of the things I love about being an astrologer the most is I have to read this chart 12 times. Look at them all. It's essentially the same chart. It's just reconceptualized, recontextualized 12 times. Then I read most of the houses in the chart. You want to be that kind of circumspect person. If you're at a meeting, go to the back of the room. Go to the front of the room. Go to the side. Don't just sit there in your seat. Go to the side of the room. go upstairs and look down. Do something. Go out in the lobby and turn doorknobs and see where you end up. Record the meeting. Play the meeting back later. You'll hear things you didn't hear. There are tricks to helping you sidestep bias. Neptune in the seventh, by the way, big bias thing. Saturn coming in is likely to help you correct some of that bias. But still, it's better to correct it in real time. It's better to see that you're off course a little bit and then kind of re-guide yourself. And this is, I would give the same presentation in a journalism class. Take photos, study the pictures. Don't sit still in the room. This is the longest I've ever sat still is doing these readings. I can sit still for long enough to do an hour and 10 minute astrology reading, but besides that, I'm walking around. I want to open up every door. This is how you avoid being personally biased, is you just keep checking. You say things and you say something funny. Notice who laughs. That's a probe. Someone else says something funny. Notice who laughs. A really attractive person walks in the room. Notice who notices. Keep probing your environment and you will learn a lot, but it is really the dress for success tip of astrology for Virgo right now. And Virgo is blessed with having a certain mental quality. By the way, here's a PS. One of the most important things you can do to make sure that you're in the right place is to ascertain whether people understand your language, speak your language, and whether there's a real meeting of communication. This appears as logos in the second house. Logos is making all kinds of aspects. It's making aspects to the Capricorn structure. It's making aspects to Salacia in Aries. It's still talking to Chiron. There's interesting stuff going on in the sign Cancer, which I can't get into today, but we'll get back into that. I'm going to draw them in though. Aspolus and Chaos entering Cancer, your 11th house, probing your environment. Probing your environment. And one of the ways you probe the mental environment is you can do the telepathic ping. You can notice who's on your wavelength, but that's, with Neptune there, that's subject to bias. One of the most important probes is words. And I think that funny words and sexual words and funny people and sexually appealing people, not merely big, charming, charismatic person. I mean people who have that je ne sais quoi, it's worth studying the reactions of people to those people. I could go on and on about this, but I'm always trying to get people off script a little bit. I'll always ask someone I'm not supposed to ask how they're doing, and I'll actually care about how they're doing. I stop and meet every dog on the street. So while I meet the dog, I'm probing the dog's response. The dog is sniffing me. I'm sniffing the dog. I'm following the leash and watching how the person is responding to me. If you have a dog or a cat, they're a very important probe into the environment. They make some of the best probes into the environment, and your dog can do something you can't do, which is run around on the ground and sniff everyone and sniff everything, right? But how does your dog respond? I for some mysterious reason in 2021 lost my sense of smell. I happen to have two canines I loved and trusted. I let them sniff everything. Well, I let your dog or your cat sniff everything and take any advantage to leave a weather station somewhere. Thermometers, barometers, and notice what's going on, because there is going to be some wild shit going down as this year develops. And there's some reason why so many people want to denature Gaia, this beautiful place, and pretend essentially that it's a computer file. You're not. You're a person, alive and well, on the planet, right now, highly sensitive, and going through major progress in your growth, as in the results of all the other progress are coming to you now. And that's what I have to say to you on this fine evening. I think 10 signs are done. That's amazing. And I'm trying not to skimp at all. I can go on. There'll be a spring reading. Thank you. Lots of love. Bye for now.